Hi and welcome to the iBuyIMD podcast, where IMD faculty meets global experts to bring you the latest on the evolving world of management and business. And here's your host of today's episode, Professor of Innovation and Strategy at IMD, Michael Wade. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. This is Michael Wade here, and I'm joined today by Katarina Bunder. She's the chairman of the board of some of Sweden's most recognized digital companies, including some familiar names like Mentimeter, Viaplay, Micronic, and the Stillfront Group. She served also as the CEO of multiple organizations in the US and in Europe, and has raised funds as an executive for many tech companies, as well as being an angel investor herself. So Katarina, thank you for joining us and welcome.
Thank you.
So maybe we could start with a little bit of a personal background. How did you get to where you are today?
So I'm born in Stockholm. I went to the Royal Institute of Technology. I have a master's degree in physics and thought I was going to be working with particle physics. I didn't do a day of work in that field after my exam. Instead, I went into the fast-growing IT industry, started in sales and marketing, and then moved into a CEO role of a company, which was later acquired by Capgemini. I moved to Seattle in the 90s, and I worked there for 15 years. And that was my intro to the venture capital world. So I got to run companies that were financed by venture capital, where you had to grow extremely fast. A new thing for me was that they were just kind of forcing you to grow the company and not care about the bottom line, which was very uncomfortable for me in the beginning. But after 15 years there, I felt that it was time to move back. However, I haven't fully moved back, so I spent about a third of my time in California and about two thirds in Europe, based in Stockholm, but with, you know, a number of different companies here.
And maybe we can talk a little bit about the difference between what it's like in the US and what it's like here in Europe. You mentioned, you know, the focus even back in the 90s around revenue, the venture capital ecosystem. Do you see that still today? Big differences between what we see in the US and Europe?
There are definitely differences, even though I will say that Europe has really been catching up. And Sweden definitely has a number of very large tech companies that have come out of there, like Klarna, Spotify, just to name a few. But I will say that there is still more capital to be had. If you're in Silicon Valley, there is still more capital. There is also more private capital. So in addition to the funds, which I do think we have here in Europe, there is more of that angel investment ecosystem, which is a little different.
And why do you think that Sweden in particular within Europe has been more successful than some other countries that you could argue are larger and have more money available and all of that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I have noticed that, as an example, when we talk about money, Sweden has a system where it's very advantageous to anyone to put some money into the stock market and not just put it into a bank account. There's a lot of interest in that. And I think there are people that feel a little bit more at ease with supporting a startup than what I see, for example, in further down south in Europe. Even though there are money here, I would say it's more like bigger family funds, not as much, you know, a person who just goes in and, you know, digs into a company and pours in some of their own money into it. I also think the fact that Sweden has had a great English education very early in school, since the 60s, means that, and we're a small country. So if you start a company, you assume from the beginning that you're going to go abroad and create something outside the country. And I think that helps when you want to build a business, to assume that you're going to be global.
And certainly Sweden has punched above its weight historically with the organizations that have come from that country, and maybe some other countries like Denmark, you could argue, is the same. And today, when it comes to technology and AI, we see, you know, very, very strong competitors in the US, interesting and strong competitors in China. Where do you think Europe is in that? And do you think there's the potential of Europe to become a major player when it comes to that area?
Well, I think, again, we have the fact that we are, even though there's EU, which everyone isn't part of, but a lot of companies, there's still a lot of differences in languages, in regulations, And we do have much more regulations in Europe than in the US. That said, Lovable, also a Swedish-based company, has done, you know, a tremendous growth in the past year or two. Fantastic. So you can definitely build it. But again, there's much more capital. I think in Europe, there's more capital coming from local and national authorities. There are funds that are, you know, coming from the state, which is great to get started. But then it doesn't go any further because there's not the next level to take it on. So there are some people who say, well, it's too easy to get that first little bag of money. And then there's such a void to get, because if you're really going to get more money, you need to get to a place where you actually have customers and you've proven that your product is working, that it's selling.
And I guess you could argue that just reinforces the fragmentation that exists within Europe. Maybe we could build on this idea of growing and scaling, because you've been involved in and continue to be involved in a lot of startups or scale-ups. And I guess in your career as a board member or as an executive, you've had to drive that kind of growth. Are there any tips and tricks that you can talk to about how to scale a promising business?
Well, I think it's really important that you don't fool yourself and think that you have a product that's working for the customer until there's actually someone who is using it and it's paying for it. And there's so many software companies, for example, where you believe you have a product, but if no one is spending the time to use it or spending money to buy it, you actually don't have a product. So you need to get there to then really push out and start, whether it's a viral product that you can push out just through digital marketing or, but also if it's I think we see now companies that are doing various physical products, maybe in the sustainability area but it doesn't matter. Whatever you do, someone needs to want the product. Someone needs to use it.
Yeah. And that kind of gets at the freemium models, right? You can give something away for free, but then eventually at some point you have to convince people to pay for that. You know, how do you do that when people are getting used to getting something for free? How do you convince them to pay for that thing?
Exactly. And I mean, and that is, it's interesting. If we take, for example, all these scooters, electric scooters that you can see all over now. And if you remember 2-3 years ago, they were everywhere. There were so many companies that were launching. If they had a decent start, they would get money and they would start building out. And it's very expensive to get all these electric scooters, and you have to have them in a number of places, and you have to have a really good process for renting them out, picking them up when they're thrown by the wayside or whatever. And I would say most people who use them were actually using them at a very low cost. It was a good time to use them because most of the cost was paid by venture capital. So they were fueling these companies, but that at the end of the day, most cities today have one or two that they've just, you know, that have survived. So there is always that chase in the beginning, which usually ends up meaning that some will fall by the wayside or be acquired by another one. So that is the name of the game if you hit a very interesting area. That there, in a way, you can say it's a good thing if there are competitors, because it means that people are interested in it, people are buying. Now, that said, sometimes you can find this really smart idea, really smart product that hasn't really existed before, but that's more rare.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm going back to your earlier point, maybe there's more of an appetite in the US to fund startups that, well, unlikely ever to make money, because some, you know, one or two will. So you make it up in the home runs that you may get occasionally, but there's maybe less of an appetite for that in other parts of the world.
Right.
Like here.
But even in the US, I mean, if you look at the funds there are a number of funds that fail. And it's interesting too, that it really has to do with when they started. Mm-hmm. So you start a fund and it's a time when, you know, I mean, if we go back to 2000, when the internet had its big bubble and everyone wanted in, and funding a company got more and more expensive, the valuations were skyrocketing. And then, of course, everything came crashing down, and then it leveled out and some people lost money and others didn't. And I think we'll see that with the whole AI, you know, whether it's AI in terms of software or hardware, or there would be lots of products fueled by hardware, there would be lots of product using AI for, you know, embedded or as productivity or whatever.
And we're here now in recording this in early 2026. Does it feel to you today like we're in one of those bubbles because of AI?
I mean, to some degree, yes, because I think there is, I think just like we saw with the internet, we will be using, there will be AI-based tools of any kind that you can think of. But if you look at very large companies today, they are maybe using some AI productivity tools in their IT department. They may be buying, and they often will check now, the buyers, you know, oh, is this AI-fueled or AI-based? Not that they necessarily know what that is. But for the most part, they haven't changed over to have AI agents working together with humans. I mean, most large companies haven't gotten to that stage yet. So in a way, you can say there's a lot still ahead of us that's going to happen. But I also think that there are a number of companies now that are getting a lot of, you know, financing that probably aren't going to survive. So we'll see. I mean, that's the exciting part. You still have to make sure that people, you know, that people want your product, that sales are happening, and you have to be really good at measuring what's happening. I mean, AI, in a way, I think that the most exciting part of this is data. Data is the real gold here. A company can probably use more of its internal data and should know that that's a resource that's becoming more and more valuable. And if you're a startup or a scale-up, you really need now, and there are tools, so there's no excuse to not know how to forecast. You really need to be good at trying to figure out how fast are my sales going to grow? How many people should I therefore hire? What can we do to the product to make it even more efficient? And so you need to be data-driven. And as a board, you need to help management by asking, you know, to make sure that they're grounded and have these systems in place.
Yeah, I think you talk about data as gold. I think that's a good analogy compared with the analogies that's often used, which is data is the new oil. But it kind of, you know, it overlooks the fact that oil is a commodity, right? Oil is undifferentiated, whereas information and data is infinitely differentiated. It's never the same. So I guess linking to what you just said about your role as a board member or board chair, so you're involved in a number of boards of companies that are going through this kind of growth stage. What advice do you give to management teams that, you know, are kind of maybe on the cusp of something brilliant, but they're not sure? What do you say to them? How do you keep them on the right track, the right direction?
Well, again, you know, it's they think they have something brilliant. So let's check and see if someone else thinks so as well. So you have to encourage them and maybe help them to figure out where should you go first. Not go everywhere, but decide where do we have the low-hanging fruit. I really adhere to the bowling alley model where you focus on a segment first and make sure that you can really hit that and be successful. And then when you're doing that, you take the next and the next and the next. And once you start growing, I think you need to know that there's going to be years of growth, and then you have to check, you know, kind of step back, and then you will grow and then step back, because it's also really important, even for a growing company, to show that you have a business model that can pay for itself. So to just push more and more money into something without knowing, is it really a self-standing, profitable business? I think that's extremely important, so that when you have a growth spurt, that you now step back and say, okay, let's now make sure that, you know, we hold our, you know, we don't go wild here and increase our costs, but really make sure that this is now a viable business with a decent margin. And then you can say, now, great, now we've proven this. Now you can bring in maybe more investors in case you now need more money to, let's say, you see, wow, here's another market and we could really take this, or an adjacent product offering or something. So investors love the fact that you've built the business. And as long as you can show that it can be profitable, they don't have a problem of investing money and the company goes into a period where it's going to use that resource until it's profitable again.
And you sometimes get pushback from other board members, investors, or management saying, no, it's too quick to focus on profitability. You know, it's a land grab. We've got to go out there and just build, 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 and we'll worry about making money later. Do you ever hear that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a constant discussion in a boardroom, especially for scale-ups. I mean, if you're a big listed company, I work with those too. And then you're usually independent directors. You're there to steer the company and you discuss strategy 3-4 years out. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's totally different. The fast-growing company usually has investors, founders, some external board members, and we're always discussing. And, you know, as a chair, I have to, you know, try to not get owner discussions in the boardroom, try to take them outside, but also understanding that you can't, you know, you can't be too strict. You have to be pragmatic. So there's always going to be that push and pull. And often the founder is really wants to go ahead faster and the investors want to rein it in a bit. And I'm there as the translator between these, you know, different ideas and moving them along.
So a board chair sounds like a very political role.
Yeah, political. It's you're some kind of cross between a mentor. You're also a coach. You are sometimes the psychologist, and I usually, you know, look at myself as, you know, sheepdogs. You know how they work. They kind of lean against, you know, one of the animals, and then that animal takes a step to the side, and then you move a little bit again, and that animal takes a step to the side. So you kind of lean towards them slowly but surely. They start moving in the same direction. So it's a matter of trying to rein everybody into, okay, let's go in this particular direction. And you have to listen to everyone, and you know. And it's not easy. I mean, there will be differing opinions. And sometimes you just have to do a compromise. Sometimes you just have to go in a direction that means that someone will be upset. You know, that's what happens in these companies.
I can imagine. Do you have any advice for, you know, people who are wishing to join boards and become board members and maybe eventually become a board chair? What should they do? What should they focus on?
Well, to begin with, I think networking is never a bad idea. In this case, it's a very good idea. This is not the kind of job where you apply. Well, I mean, you can. I mean, actually, it's not a bad idea. If you think a company is really interesting and you think you can contribute, I would say contact someone there. Talk to them. Say, I would love to come in here and help out. But you have to make sure that you talk about what you can do for them, as opposed to just shoving a CV in their face to show that you're, you know, excellent at, I don't know, business development generically. So what you need to do is read up on the company, understand the business, and then, you know, discuss how you can help in particular. But network, meet lots of people. You never know when someone's going to call you back. And just to get more experience in board work, I mean, there's a number of small associations, organizations, maybe your homeowners association. I mean, lots of places where you just learn the basics of being on a board. That's also valuable when, you know, if you have a young startup, and your experience as a board person or a board chair can actually be the thing that they need to get themselves together and work, you know, towards a strategy.
Maybe a final question. If you think about the future, look toward the future. Are you an optimist, a pessimist? How do you see the future unfolding? There's a lot of discussion about AI is going to impact this, impact that. What are your views on that?
Well, I guess I am an optimist by nature. I think it's hard to work with these types of companies otherwise. I mean, especially at an early stage, a lot of these companies, I mean, when you hear the idea, you think to yourself, that's never going to work. And then you see entrepreneurs that have grown businesses. I mean, Spotify, I actually heard about that very early on. Someone talked to me about looking at it and investing, and I thought, oh, that's never going to work, because we had a very old way of, today, seemingly old way of listening to music through our, cassette players and the radio and et cetera. So I'm an optimist. AI is going to change things for sure. It's going to make us more productive. It's going to make a lot of jobs probably more interesting. Because if you can describe let's say in the IT arena, you can describe something and then you can start building it, and using an AI tool saves you the 8 hours of just having to create code to see whether your idea even works. And I think there will be new jobs. If you look back 25 years ago, did you know anyone who was an influencer? Influencer today is a job. And there are lots of people in every country who earn money. And I mean, that's what they do every day. They influence what other people buy or listen to. And they do that through the internet, through their channels. And this didn't exist 25 years ago.
That's nice to hear an optimistic voice in a world where not everybody has a positive view of the future. Katharina Bunner, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your experiences and knowledge. It's been great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this conversation, subscribe to iBuyIMD on your favorite podcast platform. iBuyIMD is brought to you by the Institute for Management Development. Find out more at imd.org. See you soon.